Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. This is Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And today's show is going to be a little bit different, a little bit different than usual. Not that different, but a little bit different. See, on December 5, the world lost one of its most creative minds, Frank Gehry, the architect behind the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. He passed away at his home in Santa Monica at the age of 96. And maybe that's something you noticed in the news. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe you saw the name but really didn't think that much about it. I mean, 96 years old, you know, the guy had a pretty good run. Probably didn't jump out at you unless you knew of him and knew his name. But it hit me, you know, a little bit. You know, I wasn't torn up. You know, I don't need you to send condolence cards or anything like that. Unless you want to. And if you do, you know, nothing makes me feel better than a crisp $20 bill. Or, you know, except maybe a $50 bill. So slide those most. No, I can't ask for that on the radio. I'm not asking for that seriously. But still, Frank Gehry's death hit me a little bit. Why, I guess. I got to explain some of that. The main reason is that, you know, previously, you know, up to about 3 years ago or so, he didn't mean really a whole lot to me. But then 3 years ago or so, we ran this color and design event. I think we called it Down the Rabbit Hole or something like that. We ran an event for our contractors, our designers, the architects that work with Repco Light. And in that event, we focused on Frank Gehry's work and some other people. But for me, the big focus was Frank Gehry's work. But even more so, we focused on what he did, you know, professionally, personally, to tap into what seemed like nearly limitless creativity. And that whole idea, tapping into our creativity, that is so important to me. I love this topic because being creative is literally hardwired into us, you know, and we're created that way. And yet many of us, tons of us, say we just can't do it, right? That we're just not creative people. I'm sure you've heard people say it. Maybe you've said it yourself. I've said it in regards to certain things. But here's the hard reality. If you've ever said that, that you're not creative, you're wrong. You're just wrong. There's no easy way to explain that or drop that on you. You're wrong. You are by your very nature creative. It's just that you sometimes struggle to tap into it. You know, I sometimes struggle to tap into it. And being able to tap into that creativity is critical. It's almost life-giving when you can do that. You know, and it's so much bigger than just being able to be artsy and craftsy. You know, I'm not just talking artsy and crafty. It's not just being crafty. Let's just say that. It's not just about gluing popsicle sticks together or gluing cotton balls on a toilet paper roll core and making a sheep for Christmas. You know, that's not exactly what I'm talking about. It's way bigger than that. It's bigger than being able to design a cool space for your home. It's bigger than choosing great colors, you know, comfortably and confidently. Creativity is literally the thing that solves pretty much every single problem or obstacle that we face as people. You know, creativity is what gets us over those hurdles. Business problems, home problems, relationship problems, you name it, creativity solves them. Creativity is what makes fortunes for people. Creativity is what makes our homes great places to be and the time spent with our family fulfilling and crazy memorable. You know, creativity at its core brings a ton of joy into our lives because, as I said earlier, we're hardwired for it. We're created as creative beings. And when we tap into that, we're tapping into who we are at our very core. So further developing our creativity breathes new life into every single thing that we do. And that's what makes us so exciting. And that's why, you know, we talked about Frank Gehry at that color and design event so long ago. And that's why I'm going to talk about it now on the show for today. So let's get going. Why Frank Gehry? Well, for me, I really resonated with his approach to creativity. You know, his willingness to play, to experiment, to embrace the unknown. You know, that's something every single one of us can learn from. Whether you're choosing a paint color, remodeling a kitchen, rearranging furniture, you know, trying to work out a business plan for 2026, or pretty much any endeavor. You know, how he approached creativity and how he tapped into it is something we can all learn from. So in light of his passing, I thought we'd celebrate Frank Gehry a little bit by digging into some of these ideas about creativity, about curiosity, and all of that. And I promise, you know, if you're tempted to walk away because you're not hearing about how to, you know, flush a hot water heater or something, I promise, even if architecture is not your thing, there's still something here for you. All right, who was Frank Gehry? Let me start with a bit of background because his story is pretty remarkable. He was born Frank Owen Goldberg on February 28, 1929 in Toronto, Canada. Don't worry about the dates. I'm just throwing them out there so you've got a little bit of a framework, you know, to understand this and process this. I'm not going to ask you questions later, and there's no bonus points if you get it right. So, 1929, he's born. His parents were Jewish immigrants, his mother from Poland, his father's family from Russia. They raised him in a small mining town in eastern Ontario called Timmins. Now, here's something that I really love. Frank's grandpa, he had a hardware store, okay? And when Frank was little, his grandma would take wood scraps home from the store. And then on Friday nights, when little Frank would stop by for a little old visit, they'd sit on the living room floor building imaginary cities together with all those little wood scraps. You know, that's all they had. I mean, it's not all they had. I'm not saying that. You know, Frank's only toy in life was a hunk of wood. That's not what I'm saying. But that's what they did with the wood scraps. Sat on the floor, you know, nothing fancy. They didn't have the cool stuff, just hunks of wood, and made little cityscapes. And in so doing, a creative mind was starting to form. All right? Another detail from his childhood that really shaped his work. And it's going to sound crazy. But when you look at his work, and I really encourage you, go out there, Google it, Frank Gehry. If you don't know what the buildings look like, do it. And your first reaction is probably going to be to recoil because they're so strange. But listen to what I'm saying about what he's doing and why he's doing it. And I think you're going to see them with, you know, in a new light when you Google them. But anyway, here's something from his childhood that shaped his work. And when you Google the work, you're going to see this. And it's very, very interesting. See, every Thursday, young Frank, little Frank, would go to visit his grandparents again. And his grandma would take him to the market every Thursday, and they'd buy a live carp, you know, a big old fish. And they'd bring it home in a bag of water, you know, sloshing around. There it is. They'd bring it into the house, and they'd toss it in the bath. Well, they'd set it gently in the bathtub, you know, fill the bathtub up with water, and the carp would swim around. And it sounds really, really, you know, idyllic and sweet and nature-loving, but that carp was short for this world, you know, so don't get too attached to that carp. So Frank would watch it swimming all over the place, and then the next day, the fish would be gone. It'd be turned into their Sabbath dinner. But I love that story because those fish, that carp swimming around, stayed with him his whole life. Fish became a recurring motif in the work that he did. And if you look at his buildings, the curves, the movement, the way they seem to swim through space, that sounds crazy. But look at the pictures and think about that fish, and you're going to instantly see what I'm talking about. You're going to see those fish from his grandmother's bathtub. All right, so that's really cool stuff from the past. Moving on, in 1947, when Frank was about 17, his family moved to L.A. He worked as a truck driver while taking night classes, and he eventually got his architectural degree from the University of Southern California in 1954. He even spent some time at Harvard studying urban planning before he dropped out. Now, after working for several architecture firms and spending a year in Paris, he opened up his own firm in Los Angeles in 1962. And there's a ton more that I could say, a ton of great stories, you know, great anecdotes from these formative years. But, you know, I'm trying to just skim through some of the basics. All right, so he opens his own firm in 1962. And for the first 15 years or so of his practice there, Frank Gehry's pretty much designing conventional buildings. You know, same old kind of thing. You know, they were nice buildings, sure. You know, that's a nice building, Frank. They were well planned. They were acceptable to people's, you know, aesthetic palettes. They could accept what Frank was building. But they were nothing really that you'd stop and stare at for more than just a few seconds. They're just your average run-of-the-mill buildings. All right? The turning point for Frank Gehry came in 1978. He and his wife had bought a small bungalow in Santa Monica for about $50,000. All right. And instead of renovating it in a traditional manner, he did something absolutely nuts. Really, really nuts. He built a new structure around the existing house using materials that nobody in their right minds associate with fine architecture. He used corrugated metal, chain link fence, unpainted plywood, raw timber, and on and on and on and on. The neighbors hated it. One of them even sued him. You know, you're stealing my joy of life, my joie de vivre. I could have said that with a French accent, but it would have been ridiculous. You're stealing my joy of life because you built this eyesore, you know, right out my window. So the people around him weren't big fans. And when you look at pictures of it, you know, Google Frank Gehry's Santa Monica home. If you look at pictures of it, I'm not a fan. You know, I'll be honest, straight up, I don't really care for it. I can see why people didn't like it. And it's really easy. It was really tempting for me in the beginning when I started this, you know, years back when we picked Frank Gehry for our event. I started looking at some of these things and I instantly wanted to run away because this seemed like, you know, the bridge too far. These things were too weird. So it was easy for me to blow it off. Well, before you do that, before you blow it off, before you shrug it off and just act like this is silliness, before you do that, realize that this house, this experiment with chain link and corrugated metal, this was the moment that Frank Gehry found his voice. And we're going to like what he has to say later, or at least a lot of us do. But this was that moment, and this is really important. You know, this house announced to the architecture world, here's somebody who's not afraid to ask some really crazy radical questions. You know, here's somebody who's willing to use humble materials in completely unexpected ways. Here's somebody who sees possibilities where other people see limitations. And that's what caught people's attention. You know, other architects, other designers, other artists, they started watching what Frank Gehry was going to do next. And he started getting commissions for buildings that let him push even further. And each project became more and more experimental, more sculptural, more daring. He developed relationships with cutting-edge fabricators and engineers who could help him with all of these increasingly complex visions. He even began using computer software, which is funny when you hear him talk about it. You know, he struggles to wrap his brain around it. He has other people do a lot of it for him, but he knows it's necessary. He's using this stuff that I think was originally designed for Boeing jets, and he's using it or having other people use it around him to help him figure out, you know, how to turn his curved fluid sketches, you know, like I mentioned, the fish in the bathtub, you know, those curved fluid sketches, turn them into actual building structures. So he's using everything that he can to push and push and push. Now, he wasn't overnight successful. It was almost 20 years of building on that initial breakthrough before he really made it big. But that Santa Monica house was the foundation. It was where he proved to himself and to the world that he could break the rules and create something genuinely new. And that's really, really, really exciting when you find that you can create something genuinely new in a field that's been around for ages. And that journey, you know, everything that he did that led him to that point led him to Spain. And in 1997, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao opened with its swooping, you know, titanium curves that look a lot like they're about ready to take flight. I mean, it looks like flags or like fabric blowing in the wind. It is absolutely mind-blowing. Look at that picture, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, B-I-L-B-A-O. That building changed architecture forever. Philip Johnson, he's kind of the godfather of American modern architecture. He stood in the atrium and was moved to tears. He called Gehry the greatest architect that we have today. Now, that museum was so successful at transforming Bilbao from a struggling industrial city into a tourist destination that they coined a term for it, the Bilbao Effect. You know, cities around the world started commissioning famous architects, hoping to create their own cultural landmarks that would attract visitors and investment. So, what was Gehry's secret? You know, how did he create buildings that looked like nothing anyone had ever made before? Well, we're going to get into that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. You know, people often think of paint as just another line item on the project supply list. But here's the thing. Everything you do, every hour of prep, every stroke of the brush, all comes down to the quality of the paint. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. And we're in the middle of a tribute to architect Frank Gehry, who passed away on December 5th. And we ended last segment talking about, or asking, I should say, asking a simple question. What was Frank Gehry's secret? You know, the secret to unleashing his creativity and finding so much success. How did he create buildings that looked unlike anything else anybody had ever seen before? Well, it all comes down to something Frank Gehry referenced often in interviews that he gave. It's a quote from the composer John Cage, and it doesn't matter one little bit if you have no idea who John Cage is, because you're going to have no idea what he's saying in this quote anyway. We're going to have to explain it, because it's convoluted and complicated. Anyway, the quote is this, quote, "Not knowing cheers the knowing." Cheers, C-H-E-E-R-S. Not knowing cheers the knowing. Like I said, you're probably scratching your head wondering what in the world that even means. And I'm right there with you. You know, the first few times that I heard it, I was completely lost. But here's the idea. Not knowing everything when you're doing something creative isn't a hindrance. It's actually helpful. Now, let's be clear. I'm not saying that you should rip out a toilet without knowing what you're doing. In that instance, not knowing will not cheer the knowing. It's not going to make the process happier. It's not going to help you accomplish greater things, most likely. You know, there are certain skilled trades where you're absolutely going to need to know what you're doing before you start. Plumbing, electrical, structural work, all of those require knowledge and expertise. Not knowing will not cheer the knowing in those situations. But when it comes to creative decisions, you know, designing a space, choosing colors, arranging furniture, solving problems in new ways, not having all the answers is exactly where you want to be in those situations. And here's why this matters. Know-it-alls struggle to be creative. And, you know, hear what I'm saying here. I mean, people who've convinced themselves that they already have got all the answers. Just think about that. If you think you've got all the answers, you think you know everything, then the only solutions you're ever going to find are the ones that fit what you already believe. You know, you're not thinking outside the box at that point because you're convinced all the answers are already inside your box. You know, that's huge. That point every single time rattles me when I think about it. You know, we've all met people who think they've got all the answers about everything, and it's easy to feel intimidated by them or even envious of their confidence and their perceived knowledge. But keep in mind, that tendency that they have or we have, you know, because sometimes the know-it-all is us. Let's be honest. Sometimes we're that person. But that tendency actually is hampering the ability to be truly creative, to truly tap into your creativity. You miss out on a lot when you start from the point of view of having all the answers. On the flip side, if you don't feel knowledgeable or comfortable about design choices or whatever, that's actually not a bad place to be. A lot of people hold themselves back from making creative decisions in their homes because they think, I'm not a designer. You know, I'm not creative. I don't know what I'm doing. But that lack of certainty, that's not your weakness. That's your opening. That's where creativity lies. Now, when you think you know exactly what you're supposed to do, white trim, let's say, neutral walls, furniture against the walls, when you think you know exactly what's supposed to be done, your ego gets involved. And by that, I mean you become self-conscious. You know, you start worrying about whether or not you're doing it right. Or, you know, maybe your brain doesn't go in that direction. But still, if you're firmly entrenched in the idea that you know all the options, all the things that you can do, you're going to be really, really limited in where you can move with this. But when you embrace not knowing, when you say, I'm not sure what's going to happen if I paint the ceiling navy blue, but let's find out. If you do that, you've got to humble yourself. You've got to be open. You've got to experiment. And that creates space for play, for discovery, and for something genuinely new to emerge. And I'm not saying that you necessarily experiment in that situation by putting navy blue onto your ceiling to find out if you like it. There are other ways other than just rolling paint up there to check it out ahead of time. You know, software programs and things like that where you can look at blues on a ceiling. You can even upload your own space and put a navy blue on the ceiling. So I'm not saying experiment to that level, but just ask the question, what if? You know, that's the big takeaway. Ask what if. You know, embrace the unknown. Stop thinking that you need to have all the answers. Stop thinking that you know all the answers before you start. And you're going to have way more options, and it's going to be way easier to lean into your creativity. Now, all right, embracing the unknown. It's an easy thing to say, but how do you do that? You know, how do you go from I don't know to let's find out? Well, we're going to get to that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Think about it. You spend hours prepping, sanding, taping, and then finally painting. Don't throw all that work away with an inferior product. The paint isn't just another supply. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. We're looking at the life and work of architect Frank Gehry and how his philosophy can help all of us, you know, be more creative with anything that we tackle. Okay, last segment. We ended by saying that we needed to embrace the unknown, to stop knowing everything and just embrace the unknown. And that sounds a little bit weird. What am I exactly getting at? Basically, I'm talking about curiosity. You know, we've got to have a sense of curiosity. Frank Gehry spent a lifetime being curious, asking questions that seemed impossible. I love the questions that he asked. He was asking things like, how do we add motion to brick and glass? You know, how do we infuse feeling and emotion into steel and cement? How do we make buildings that don't just sit there, but kind of dance? Those questions drove every single thing that he did, every design that he came up with. The accepted understanding is that buildings don't have motion. You know, glass, not good motion. You know, they're not supposed to have motion. Glass doesn't move. You know, that's the idea. That's what we all accept as, you know, a known quantity. But he wasn't willing to accept those established answers. He was asking, what if? Like we talked about earlier, what if it could move? What if we tried this? What happens when we do that? And here's the key. Asking those impossible questions opens up possibilities that realistic questions can't even touch. You know, not even close. With realistic, reality-based questioning, you're always hemmed in. You know, this is so similar to what we were just talking about. But when you open your questions up to the world that seems impossible, really, all of a sudden, now you've hit this point where the sky is the limit. Frank Gehry did that, and he asked those questions. He asked the impossible questions, and he did find a way to make buildings and glass move, or at least feel like they're moving. But it never would have happened without asking those impossible questions first. Now, I know what you're thinking. I don't know what you're thinking. I suppose I know what you're thinking. That's great for Frank Gehry and his multi-million dollar buildings, but what does that mean for me and my living room? Well, everything. Everything. You know, so let's bring this home, literally, you know, into our own homes, because that same principle that we just covered, everything we've talked about so far, applies to us on a singular level, you know, each one of us personally. And it applies to you whether you're designing a museum, you know, which I'm sure lots of us are, or designing, you know, a shed for the backyard or a garden, or, you know, maybe we're just picking a color for the living room. Whatever we're doing, a business plan, like I mentioned, you know, for 2026 for our business, you know, it doesn't have to be design related necessarily. But if we're working on something in a creative manner, this is going to apply to us, this principle. And it all starts with asking questions and challenging your own assumptions. You know, when you're stuck with anything, step back and ask what if. So let me give you some examples to make this concrete. Let's say you've got a small bedroom. Maybe it's your kid's room. Maybe it's a guest room. And you look at it and you think it's too small for anything but a bed. You know, it's kind of frustrating. You know, there's no way I can expand the space. Thought about that, but, you know, this is what we've got. There's no room for a desk, no room for a sitting area, just a tiny little bedroom. That's the reality of it. But is it the reality of it? You know, if you challenge the assumption, what happens? You know, what if you ask if there are other options you're not even remotely considering? What if you raise the bed up? You know, what if you built a loft bed? Suddenly you've got all that space underneath for a desk, you know, for a reading nook, for storage. I did this with my daughter's room. We spent a year with this tiny little room being frustrated because there was no real way for her to kick back and turn it into the room that she wanted because it was small and the bed took up so much space. And we had small ideas where we thought about getting a smaller bed, but we were kind of at that point already. We were at a twin bed. How much smaller can it get? A prison cot? You know, we didn't want to go to that level. So we kind of just lived with it. And then we challenged our assumptions. We kind of washed the board clean and started over and said, wait a minute, what about going upwards with the bed? What about a loft bed? So we did that, and the space completely transformed. You know, that impossible room that was way too small suddenly became functional and cool. You know, here's another one. You're staring at your living room, and you're thinking the room is just boring, right? Dead boring. The only wall colors that work in this space with my furniture and all of those things, all of those colors, they're just the same old thing that I've used forever. You know, I've already tried all the options that I can use in this space. I just need to have these neutrals. That's all I've got. So it's boring. You know, you resign yourself to beige or gray again and again and again and again. But hold on. Ask the question, is that really true? Are you really right about that? You know, and it's such a simple question to ask, but it is kind of, you know, shattering in a sense because we don't live in that zone. We just assume we've explored everything. Maybe we tried some other colors and they didn't work. And we've landed on this conclusion that no other colors will work. Challenge that. Are there other colors that you haven't tried that could work? And even if there aren't, even if it turns out that, nope, you're right, you're kind of stuck with these neutrals on the walls, you know, maybe your furniture really does limit those wall color options. Well, what about the trim color? You know, everybody says trim has to be white or an off-white or something like that. But we all know, you know, if you follow design at all, you know that that's being challenged. You know, we're seeing more and more color showing up on trim. What if you painted your trim a deep charcoal color or a rich navy or even a black? Suddenly the boring beige walls or the gray walls or whatever become interesting again, you know, because of the trim color. What about the ceiling? You know, we talked about it at the end of the last segment. You know, we call it the fifth wall for a reason. You know, we almost always paint the ceilings flat white. But what if you didn't? Like I said, we covered that already, but that's another one to question. Maybe you're arranging furniture. This is a big one, you know, and you've always got the couch put against the wall. You've got chairs here or whatever. And you're just kind of stuck with that. You feel like that's the only way these pieces of furniture in that space are going to shake out and work. You know, and you just live with it and you feel bored with it sometimes. Well, what if you pulled the couch off the wall a little bit? Would that work? What if you took that set of matching chairs and split it up? You know, send one of those chairs to another room in the house and bring a coordinating chair, you know, something that will work in the color scheme, but a different chair, a different style in to replace it. You know, that will completely shake up that room. And it's something that a lot of us don't even think to question or think to try. You know, in fact, a lot of designers, will, if they buy sets or have sets of chairs, they'll split them up right away. They'll break the sets in order to get visual interest and stuff going on in a space. A lot of us don't think to go that way. I've got these two chairs. That's what I've got to work with. I got to keep them together because they're a set. Challenge that assumption. Break it up. Here's one more. Kitchen cabinets. You know, the standard has previously for years and years and years been white or wood stain, right? Now, we've seen more color come into the kitchen, you know, grays and brighter colors if you're feeling adventurous. But a lot of us live in that zone where we're just not willing to stretch out into that. We're afraid of it, or we don't even think about it when it comes to our own design. But remember, designers are challenging that all the time, that it has to be white or gray or wood stained or something like that. We're seeing all kinds of stuff show up. Deep greens, moody blues, you know, darker lower cabinets with lighter uppers. There's a whole world beyond the standard options that you may have locked yourself into. But in order to find those, you have to ask, what if I went in a different direction? What if there was another direction to go? You know, if even one of those ideas hit you and you found yourself thinking, oh, yeah, I never, ever thought of that. That's the point. You know, that's what I'm getting at. So here's your challenge. Ask those questions. Challenge your assumptions. Challenge your premises. And if you still find yourself unwilling to jump in, ask another question. You know, what's actually holding me back from trying something different? Is it a real constraint, like a lease that won't let you paint? Or is it a budget that's truly maxed out? You know, those are real constraints. I get that. If it's just fear, though, fear that it won't work, that people might think it's weird, that you're going to regret it, well, then, you know, challenge that as well. You know, because here's the thing. Paint is reversible. Furniture can be rearranged. You know, just pulling it off the wall or moving chairs around. Yes, it's not terribly fun to move chairs throughout a home. But, man, when the payoff can be so big, it's worth the risk. You know, even that loft bed that we built, that can be taken down if it doesn't work. Yeah, it costs money. I get that. But at the end of the day, the stakes are actually pretty low compared to the potential payoff. You know, making a space that really feels like yours, that solves a problem that you're dealing with, that makes you happy every time you walk in. You know, that's huge. That's a big payoff and it's worth the risk. All right, here's what I want you to take away from all of this. You know, not that you need to hear it from me, because really, who am I? It's so crazy that I'm giving permission to people. But hear this, hear what I'm saying. You've got permission to experiment. You know, some people really do need to hear that it's okay to do this, that they need permission. I certainly don't have grandiose ideas about who I am. I'm just saying, go ahead and experiment. You know, be curious, ask what if. You know, it could be big, like Frank Gehry's buildings. It could be small, like playing with the decor on the mantle. You know, the principle is always the same. But when you do that, here's the hard truth. Asking impossible questions and searching for the answers means you need to be willing to create garbage. All right, to fail, to make mistakes, to produce things that don't work, because not every single experiment or trial is going to produce sheer gold, right? You got to keep that in mind. Don't be disheartened. Frank Gehry knew this 100%. You know, he was completely willing to fail. that house in Santa Monica that we talked about at the beginning, you know, using corrugated metal, chain link, and all of that. Some people think it's brilliant. Some people, you know, I don't think they've got the best eyesight, but some people think it's brilliant. And maybe brilliant and beautiful are completely different things. They are completely different things. So some people think it's brilliant. Some people think it's an eyesore, but it was necessary. It was that experimentation on that house that made the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao possible later. You know, Gary would create hundreds of models for a single building, constantly adjusting, constantly experimenting. And we can all do that same thing on a smaller scale. You know, sample paint colors, paint big swatches right on the wall and live with them for a few days. You know, try it out that way. Move furniture around. You know, be willing to give that a try. You know, you're never going to know unless you give it a try. Buy one piece of different hardware. You know, maybe you want to mix metals or you're curious about that or what new hardware would look like in your kitchen. You know, buy one piece. You don't have to go all in. Just give yourself permission to experiment, to play, and try. Don't feel like every single decision that you make has to be perfect and permanent. Some of it's going to be garbage, and that's okay because you don't get to the really good stuff, the gold, without making and walking through some of that garbage. Just be aware, because walking through the garbage isn't always a lot of fun, and we can get disheartened. Don't be disheartened. There's gold ahead. You got to just keep walking. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to wrap all of this up right after this. You're listening to Home in Progress, where the projects are real, the mistakes, they're educational, sometimes painful, mostly educational, and the only thing more stubborn than that old wallpaper on your bathroom wall is your determination to get it fixed. Proudly sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Paint with a purpose, people who care, and everything you need to get the job done right. As we get to the end of this, let's talk about some of the elephants in the room. You know, things you're going to encounter if you really start to do some of these things. And we've already hinted at it a little bit, but being curious and being experimental, of course, means dealing with fear. You know, it means risking that you're going to make something that doesn't work. Earlier, I called it garbage. You're going to make garbage in order to get to the gold. Garbage is an incredibly harsh term. I should have used something more gentle. But I was trying to just whip everybody into shape. But you're going to make stuff that maybe isn't perfect. It's not amazing every single time. And you're going to have to just plow through with that and deal with that. It also means, you know, if you're experimenting, it means you're going to potentially be dealing with criticism. You know, Frank Gehry certainly dealt with a lot of criticism, you know, for his wild designs, a lot of criticisms, you know, and he knew, I'm sure, that he only heard just a fraction of the criticisms that were leveled his way. You know, I personally have leveled a lot of criticism directly at Frank Gehry. He just never knew about it. I'm sure lots of us, you know, lots of you out there listening have leveled criticism at the man. So he dealt with a ton of criticism and he knew it was out there. You know, he wasn't immune to doubt, you know, self-doubt. He wasn't this supremely confident guy that just plowed through no matter what. He struggled, but he learned to use that insecurity that he felt, that struggle that he was going through. He used that as fuel rather than letting it stop him. So for us in our homes, you know, the stakes, they're way lower. You know, if you paint a room a bold color and you hate it, you know, you can repaint it. You know, the whole world isn't going to know about it unless you blog about it. And even then, blog about it. I'm so stuck in the past. If you Instagram about it or you TikTok about it or whatever the kids do, whatever anybody who's successful at social media does, if you do that and you've got a large following, even then the whole world doesn't know about it, just the portion of the world that you impact. Frank Gehry built something. Pretty much the whole world knew about it, and if they hated it, well, yeah, there was a lot of criticism coming his way. We don't have to deal with that kind of thing. You know, we don't have to have that kind of stress, so don't put that kind of stress on yourself. Don't feel that fear and don't let it stop you. You know, if you try something with your decor and it doesn't work, just change it. You know, the beauty of working in your own home is that you get to define success. You get to decide what works. Frank Gehry talked to his students. I thought this was really great. It's a really great point as we get to the end of this. He talked to the students about finding their creative signature. You know, he'd say, when you write your signature, you know, and your colleague writes their signature, you can each recognize your own. You know, there's a you that's different from everybody else. Well, the same is true or should be true for your home. Your home should reflect you, you know, your signature, your personality, your interests, your story, not what's trending on Pinterest, not what the design shows say you should do. Your home should reflect you. Maybe you love color and everybody's telling you neutrals are the thing. Well, be curious about what happens if you trust your instinct. You know, maybe you love mixing old and new, vintage and modern, and everybody's telling you to just pick a lane, experiment. You know, see what happens when you bring those elements together. Maybe you're drawn to bold patterns or unexpected materials or quirky details. Don't apologize for that. That's your signature emerging. Let me tell you to make this point about my living room. It's a very, very, very strange room. You know, guests who see it usually have something to say about it. You know, they don't just remain quiet. And the thing that makes it a little bit weird is our entertainment center. You know, one of those old 90s things where people hide a little TV inside this little cabinet thing. You know, maybe Lucy and the Pevensies or the Pevensies are going to escape into Narnia through the kind of thing. Well, anyway, we've got one of those in the living room. Ours doesn't go to Narnia. Spoiler alert. But it's got a TV in it, and the top of that piece of furniture is graced with this huge bust of Cleopatra. All right, let that sink in a minute. A huge bust of Cleopatra in my living room on top of the entertainment center. You know, I bought her years back for one of Repco Light's design events, you know, a different one from the Frank Gehry one that we're talking about here. But I bought her for that event, and she was just too weird to get rid of, you know, when the event was over. So I put her on top of the entertainment center, and I spent the next 3 years, for some unknown reason to my brain, but I spent the next 3 years accumulating brass candlesticks of every height, you know, and I started surrounding Cleo with them. And now there's got to be like 30 candlesticks or more up there. You know, no candles, just the candlesticks. I have no idea, like I said, why I did this. People who walk in think it looks really weird, and they usually make jokes about it. But you know what? I love it. I absolutely love it. I love the story that I think of when I see Cleopatra up there. You know, how I bargained for her, and I got the person in the store to come down on price. You know, that's something I never do. I am the person you want to buy whatever you're selling, because I will come and give you exactly what you're asking for or more, because I don't ever want you to think that what you have isn't valuable, right? I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I will just shell out the money, whatever you're asking. With Cleopatra, it was the first time ever that I actually talked somebody down and was successful at it. You know, so every time I see her, I remember that story. You know, I remember all the fun trips to accumulate and acquire these candlesticks. And I like how it looks. You know, I like that I've never seen another house with a Cleopatra bust sitting on an entertainment center surrounded by candlesticks. It's weird. It's unique. It's unusual. It's me. So do that for you. Find your own signature. Experiment. Ask questions. Try that thing that makes you a little bit nervous, because Frank Gehry said it best, quote, "Your best work is your expression of yourself. You may not be the greatest at it, but when you do it, you're the only expert," end quote. All right, before I wrap up, I want to touch on something else about Frank Gehry's work that I find really inspiring. You know, his buildings weren't just about aesthetics. They were about community and about transformation and about improving people's lives. The Guggenheim in Bilbao, it wasn't just a museum. It was about revitalizing a dying city, you know, giving it new life, new purpose, new identity. The Walt Disney Concert Hall, it wasn't just a concert venue. It was about creating a space where people could experience music in a profound way, where the orchestra and the audience would feel connected to each other. Frank Gehry said, quote, "Architecture is a small piece of this whole human equation. But for those of us who practice it, we believe in its potential to make a difference, to enlighten and to enrich the human experience, to provide a beautiful context for life's drama." Well, the same is true for our homes. They're not just shelters, you know, not just four walls and a roof. They're the backdrops for our lives. You know, they're where we raise our families, where we celebrate, where we mourn, where we rest, where we create, you know, where we become ourselves. And when we approach our homes with curiosity, with creativity, you know, when we make them truly ours, we're creating that beautiful context for our own life's drama. You know, Frank Gehry lived 96 full years, worked almost till the very end. You know, did a ton of things. His buildings dot skylines around the world. But what I think I can learn most from him isn't about the iconic buildings. It's approaching the world with curiosity, you know, asking questions, being willing to experiment, to play, to create some garbage, and on the way, create something good. All right. That's all the time we've got for this. I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Thanks for being a part of it. If you want to catch it again, you can find it online at repcolite.com. You can also find it as a podcast and subscribe, and you'll never miss an episode. All right. Whatever you do today, make sure paint's a part of it. Make sure you're asking questions, pushing boundaries, you know, challenging premises. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I'll see you next week. For Home in Progress, I'm Dan Hansen. Thanks for listening.